सहनावतु सहनौ भुनक्तु सहवीर्यं करवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा विद्विषावहै ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः। Swami Advaitmananda ji asked me to talk about Vedanta. Many of you may have heard this word Vedanta. Some of you may not have heard. Vedanta is a knowledge coming down to us through the succession of the teachers and the disciples, beginning from the beginning of creation. In the Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna says, so Bhagavad Gita, as you know, is a dialogue between Lord Krishna and Arjuna, where Lord Krishna imparts this knowledge to Arjuna. At one point, Lord Krishna says to Arjuna, Imam vivasvade yogam proktavanam avyayam. Hey Arjuna, the knowledge that I imparted to you today is a knowledge, same knowledge that I imparted to Vivaswan in the beginning of creation. From then on, this tradition of teaching through a succession of the teachers and students is coming down to us. The Swamiji chanted the verse, Sadashiva Samarambham Shankaracharya Madhyavam Asmadasaya Paryantam. This tradition of teaching began from Sadashiva, from Lord Shiva, of which Adi Shankaracharya was the middle link, coming down to our own teachers. The purpose of saying this is that what our teacher is teaching us, the same as what was taught in the ancient times, and it's the same knowledge that is handed down by the teacher to the disciples. The only change is the language in which it is taught, the context in which it is taught. Because naturally, as the kind of students change, even the same thing also is communicated in a language that the present day audience can understand. But the same knowledge is taught. Sometimes a question is asked, Swami, these are old time, ancient, thousands of years old this tradition is. What was taught thousands of years ago may have been relevant at that time. What use do we have today in the, as Swamiji said, this technological age? Is it not that our problems today, the situation that we are facing, the problems that we are facing in life, are they not altogether different from the problems that people in ancient times faced is not that the world today is completely different. Is it not that problems totally are different? There were no planes and no trains and no cars and no TVs and there was no internet. Nothing was there at that time. There's no democracy. So today things are quite different. The whole society, social structure is different. So the social values are different. Our situations are different. Today we are in a competitive society. Today it is success or performance that counts. Today we have lots of stresses. Those days life was very simple. And therefore, the teaching that was imparted to those people in those conditions, how can it apply to us today? That is a very pertinent question. So we must first clarify this as to whether this ancient knowledge is useful to us today or not. This ancient knowledge, is it relevant to us? Otherwise, what's the use? Why should we waste our time listening to it? It's all right. Lord Krishna taught something to Arjuna. It's nice to know. The Rishi is imparted knowledge, okay. We will salute that. But if it does not have anything to contribute in our life, if that knowledge cannot help us to deal with the situations today, if that knowledge cannot help us in solving our problems today, then we have no use. Understand that after all, we are only interested in ourselves. Human being is primarily interested in his own self. And whatever I do, I always do for myself. And this is said in the ancient time also. In a dialogue between a famous sage, Yajnavalkya, who imparted this knowledge to his wife, Maitreyi, who also became his disciple. To Maitreyi, Sri Yajnavalkya said, Atmastu kamaya sarvam priyam bhavati. Hey Maitreyi, whatever is dear to one is dear because the self is dear. Navare patyuh kamaya patih priyo bhavati. A Maitreyi, a wife loves her husband. Not for the sake of husband, for the sake of the self. Same way, navare jayai kamaya jaya priyo bhavati. It is not for the sake of the wife, the husband loves the wife, it is for the sake of his own self. Would you believe this? Parents love their children. You love your people who take care of you, caregivers. You love your wealth. You love your job. You love your status. Love your name, fame, recognition, power. You love all of this. The question is, do we love all these, what we may call, the worldly accomplishments? Or worldly materials, objects, accomplishments? Do we love them for their own sake? Swami, I love my job. I'm a millionaire, I love my $1 million. Even $1 million also, do I love only for the sake of those $1 million? Upanishad says, even that also we love for ourselves. If somebody brings a huge suitcase with a cash containing $1 million, Swamiji, the other day, you made a pitch for fundraising for your projects in India. Here is the money, $1 million, cash, take it. So, wow, what happened? Why are you giving it to me? This money I just stole. The police is behind this. I'm giving it to you. Do you think you'll take that money? You'll take that money? No. The other day, somebody appeared for an interview for a very senior position in a bank, large bank. And those who were interviewing him told him that you are selected for the position of general manager. But one thing we should tell you is those who have been general managers in the past have a history of having had a heart attack in 6 months. Thank you. I don't want this position. Whatever we want, ultimately we want for sake of ourselves. Or you can say, for the sake of a happy self, for the sake of a pleased self. Is it so or not? That is why, when these two got married, said, I love you, I love you, I love you. After a while they say, I love you, I love you, I love you. I think we need some space. Why? Because no more each one became a means of the pleased self for the other. They loved each other as long as each one was pleased with the other. The love disappeared when no more this person is a means of my pleased self. As long as you please me, so long you become the object of my love. When you start displeasing me, I can put up with you. In India, people put up with. So people in India believe, look, our society is so wonderful, you know, there are no drivers. I said, give them the freedom. Give the people the freedom that they have in Western countries like United States, then you see what happens. But we love anything for the sake of a happy self or a pleased self. Understand that what we love is the pleased self. That has not changed. You follow? This formula, which was stated in the ancient times, the same formula is applicable even today. Would you say or not? Whether your clothes are different, the language is different, the dwelling is different, environment is different, everything is different. But this one thing remains the same, that everyone loves whatever they love for the sake of pleased self. Meaning that what we love in our life is the pleased self. Meaning that what we love is happiness. That is not changed. And therefore, we love. Is there something else that also we love? Please tell me. I love happiness. Is there something else also that I love, you think? Just we say it, that whatever else we appear to love is only for the sake of happiness, for myself. So in that sense, each one of us is similar. In other ways, we are all different from each other also, really. You might even ask this, usually in India also, people think that all this is meant for old people. For retired people, what do we have to do with it? Bhagavad Gita is meant for retired people, who have nothing else to do and who are good for nothing. As long as you are good for something, you will work. When you become good for nothing, then study Bhagavad Gita. That's the usual understanding, is it not? This young man is married and comes to his teacher. Says, "Sir, I got married. Congratulations." The teacher said, "I'm very happy. I congratulate you." And he told them some words of wisdom and said, "Here is the book of Bhagavad Gita. Please make it a point to study some pages every day, both of you." "Guruji, why should I worry it now? That happened later. Bhagavad Gita I'll do later on, there is enough time. Right now many other things to do. So Bhagavad Gita can wait." Same young man comes after a year. Says, "Guruji, I got a new job. You know something? Now I have taken insurance." So the Guruji says, "What is this insurance? Don't you know? Life insurance. For what? I'm not married, I have a child. If something happens to me, then what? Oh, I thought that you're going to live long. When it came to Bhagavad Gita, we'll do it in future. When it comes to life insurance, I should have it now." So everybody thinks that this thing has no practical application. Unfortunately, that is the view of people in India, that all these spiritual things and all these Bhagavad Gita and Vedanta and all this is not of any practical use, it is a pastime. With nothing else to do, go to sannyasa ashram, attend those lectures. So we think, many people think it's meant for sannyasis. Understand that neither Lord Krishna was a sannyasi, nor Arjuna was a sannyasi. Were they sannyasis? No. If this was only meant for sannyasi, then Lord Krishna would not have taught it to Arjuna, is it not? Arjuna was a very active person, living an active life, had a very, very real problem in front of him. What to do, what not to do? And that same kind of problems we have today also. Arjuna had this problem. Swami will teach you, but he's in the midst of battlefield. He came to battlefield determined to fight the battle. But then, when his chariot was taken and brought between the two armies, and when he surveyed the people in the two armies, he saw that both the armies are people who are his near and dear ones, his kith and kin. How can I fight against my own people? How can I kill my own people? He became extremely sad. So thus, a conflict came. What is the right thing to do and what I like to do. Bhagavad Gita began with a conflict. What is right to do and what I like to do. Arjuna knew what was right to do. He was a Kshatriya. He belonged to the warrior class. His role was to protect Dharma. And Arjuna, who is one of the Pandavas, represents dharma, righteousness. Duryodhana represents adharma. We know it very well. So this was a conflict between dharma and adharma, righteousness and unrighteousness. And it is the duty of a kshatriya to protect dharma. So what is the right thing to do for a kshatriya? Protect dharma. That's why he came to the battlefield. But now, something happened there. Sometimes people, you know, get what they call cold feet. They come all the way to the marriage. And then, when he says, Savadhan, you know, something happens, he says, oh, can you postpone it for a while? When you confront the real situation, then very often you become very nervous. Arjuna also became very nervous. So what was right was to fight for protecting dharma. But that meant that he had to fight with his own relatives and friends and near and dear ones, and so he did not like it. So what he liked is not to fight. What is right is to fight. You follow? Just an example. A conflict between what is right to do and what I like to do. No, that is a modern conflict. In the modern times, when we file our income tax return every year, what is right to do and what I like to do. You and I are all law-abiding citizens. There are billionaires who have very sophisticated advisors how to plan the tax and how to have things in foreign countries and I don't know what they do. I mean, it's just very complex things. What is right to do is to pay taxes. What I like to do is to avoid paying taxes. When you pass through customs, same thing. They ask me, Swamiji, do you have something that is dutiable? Do you have something to declare? Same conflict. What is right to do is to declare what all dutiable goods I have. What I like to do is to save that duty. Isn't it so? Even a Swami also, it's not that, you know, money is dear to everybody, looks like. So the Swami also does not seem to be free from the fascination or attachment or attraction for money. So even in the mind of Swami, this conflict arises. What is right to do and what I like to do. What is right to do, pay the customs duty of 100,000 rupees. What I like to do is to say, no, I don't have anything to declare, and walk out. Does it sound modern? So it is true that something that has changed, but there is something that has not changed. From the ancient times, our dress has changed, the language may have changed, the food may have changed, the habitat may have changed, all kinds of social structures may have changed. But this conflict that a human being has to face, that has not changed. What I'm saying is that certain things just do not change. The sun, same sun, keeps on shining for millions of years, doesn't change. Same moon, same earth, same water, same fire, same hunger. Same thirst, Meaning that the basic things do not change. And we just pointed out, what's the basic thing? That we want to be happy. Whatever I do for the sake of happiness. Is it not so? No, that is where Vedanta comes. So, our endeavor constantly is to work hard and acquire things that will make us happy. So you work hard to get a car, work hard to get a house, work hard to get promotion, work hard to rise up to CEO, etc., etc. All these efforts you make, lot of hardships. You know, these days when young people get hired, recruited by these consulting companies like McKinsey and whatever, you know something? These fellows will work for at least 14 hours a day. It's given. If you go to McKinsey, go to Ernst & Young, and any of those fellow things, or J.P. Morgan, 14 hours. Work hard. They do. Yes, they do. Why? So that we rise in our career, so we become happy. So understand that whatever we do, we need for happiness of the self, and we work hard. The point is, do we get happiness or not? We don't need not go anywhere else. Ask ourselves, after all that I have acquired in my life, after countless desires I have fulfilled, after lots of achievements and accomplishments I have in my life, if we have to prepare a balance sheet of the life, not in terms of dollars and cents, in terms of self-satisfaction, if we have to, you know, a good accountant we should be, and then we should always keep account of our life, is it not so? So we propose a different kind of balance sheet. You always make a balance sheet as far as the income and stuff is concerned. But this different kind of balance sheet, what is it? Have I gained more, am I more satisfied than what I was 1 year ago, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 25 years ago? If you're honest about it, we'll find that I cannot say that I am more satisfied with myself than what I was many years ago. I cannot say that I'm a happier person than what I was 10 years ago. If, I'm not saying that you can be, but as long as a person thinks that happiness is in the wealth and career and recognition and name and fame and power, as long as a person thinks that is where success is, that is where happiness is, so long I can assure you that he or she cannot discover any greater satisfaction in life than what was there. You need not go anywhere, you ask yourself. If you ask ourselves, that's what we'll find. You know what it means? It means that all our endeavors, all the hard work that we've been doing in the whole of the life, for becoming a physician, for becoming an attorney, for becoming an engineer, for becoming a CEO, for becoming all of this, a businessman, millionaire, billionaire,
Yes, what I have has increased greatly, but what I am in terms of my personal satisfaction in myself has not increased at all.
Swami, how do you say that? How do you know what is happening? But then thing is that when a person gets $1,000,000, does he retire? No, he works harder than before. You know what? He now wants $1,000,000. He becomes $10,000,000, he wants to have $10,000,000.
I'm not saying you should not have, okay? I'm not saying you should not do that. All I'm saying is that is it not that more we get, more our desire also becomes stronger to get more. Is it not so? Is it not that all these accomplishments have, they seem to follow the law of diminishing return? That even the BMW car that I wanted, $50,000, I got it. I'm ecstatic, happy. An 18-year boy, you know, a young man, you give him this kind of a car, because that was his condition with his father. His father said in SAT, if you score 2,350, then I'll give you this car. He worked hard, scored, give me that car. He's ecstatic. How long will that be? For 1 day, 2 days, 3 days, 15 days, 1 month, 2 months, 3 months, 6 months, then what? Then you get used to it. Is it not so? Our mind can get used to anything. Our new house also, which we build after so much hard work, 6-bedroom house in a hill, and you know, in a very fantastic real estate property, and we are so proud. Everybody comes and I take him. Swami, let me give you a tour of my house. And you do, and with the pride, he says, Swami, I said, what is this? Oh, this is our bathroom. I thought, my house was much smaller than this. Their bathroom is bigger than the house that I had. In that, there is a closet that is as good as my apartment. And I bless them. I am happy that they have made this progress. Very good. This excitement, how long do we have? 6 months? A year? Swamiji, I don't have any time to enjoy my house. Only my guests enjoy that. Meaning that anything that we acquire seems to follow the law of diminishing return. You know something? You know what it says? It means? It means that none of those things can give me happiness. That's what you think, Swamiji. What do you know about happiness? Like, come to me, I'll give you happiness. Takes me to a nice restaurant, here is, you know, takes me to a movie theater, nice restaurant, nice tower, all right, fine. All of these things have diminishing return. There is nothing that can give me a sustained experience of happiness. And therefore, if you really examine, you find that none of those can give me happiness. They can give me comfort. Comfort is one thing, happiness is another thing. Even when you become a CEO, yes, you're very proud, and now a lot of people respect you, good, for a period of time. Then you get used to that also. So this is a basic problem of human being. Upanishad says that human being is born with an extrovert mind, and therefore he always looks out for success and happiness, never looks at himself. He never looks at where real happiness and success are. He never looks at them. Always looks out there and does not find it. To find something, we should look where it is. Many years ago, two persons were traveling from what was called Madras. Those days called Madras, now it is Chennai, but Madras to Delhi. Many years ago. Those days, that train trip would take 2-3 days, not like today. Once in the trip from Madras to Delhi, two persons were traveling in first class coupe. You know what is a coupe compartment? Only two berths are there. Normally a first class compartment, 4 berths, but a coupe has only 2 berths. One of the passengers was a very wealthy person from Madras who was going to Delhi with some cash money. Now, you know why people go to Delhi with cash money, that you know. Whatever agenda he must have. Other one was a very skilled thief from Delhi who came to know that this man is traveling from Madras to Delhi. So that fellow made it a point to get birth in the same coupe compartment. So now we have in this compartment two passengers, the wealthy man with a lot of cash money and a skilled thief whose express purpose is to steal that money. Looks like this businessman knew for whatever reason. So as they're traveling the train, you know, during the day you share that same berth, so this businessman is sitting near the window, this fellow is sitting on the other end of the same berth. This fellow takes out his suitcase. Who? The businessman. And deliberately holds it like this, so the other fellow cannot see what is behind the cover of the suitcase. So he opens and counts. But the thief is pretty smart. From the corner of his eyes, he saw that, hey, he was counting cash money. All right, this is where the money is. He was determined tonight. So night came, each one of them had their dinner, went to the bathroom to change, came back. The wealthy person is sleeping on the berth, lower berth. Other fellow is sleeping on the upper berth. Soon enough, the man sleeping on the lower berth started snoring. So this fellow knew that now this fellow is sleeping. So he quietly comes down. And he is like a thief, like a cat, so that nobody would even recognize it, nobody would even sense his movement. He had all kinds of master keys. He catches hold of that suitcase in which there is money, opens it, no money. Surprise, I saw behind the lid of the suitcase, I saw that fellow counting the money. What happened? Maybe the fellow is hidden the money in his, not briefcase, to suitcase. So this fellow examined all his luggage. Could not find money. Disappointed, went back to his berth. Next day afternoon, again that businessman opens his briefcase with a lid in such a manner that that fellow cannot see, but again he sees from the corner, he's still again counting the money. He says, wow, where does this fellow hide money? So this was, tonight was the last night now. Next morning they were going to reach Delhi. He decided, tonight I'll make sure, I will check everything. Not only luggage, maybe he's hiding this money on his own self. I will examine everything. So next night, same way. First you open the suitcase, a briefcase, no money. Suitcase, luggage, no money. Then he checks his person. No money? Where does the money, where does he hide? Again disappointed, went back to his berth, fell asleep. Next morning, Delhi is coming. Look at that businessman. Again he opens his briefcase with a lid and counts some money in such a manner that fellow sees he's counting money. So now this thief asks that businessman, he says, sir, you are my guru. I am a famous thief from Delhi. I am traveling with you for the express purpose of stealing your money. But you are my guru. Please, I do not want your money. Please just tell me, where did you hide the money? That's all I want. Where did you hide the money? He says, under your pillow. Meaning that you may look for a thing everywhere. If you don't look where it is, you can never find it. Similarly, human being of the 21st century also, just as the ancient man was also searching for happiness in the thing that he had, and so also the modern human being also searching for happiness. The only one objective in life. That has not changed. No, today, these days you'll have happiness, that day, those days they want an unhappiness. No. And so the agenda is the same. The method also is same. Those days also he was searching for it outside. In whatever he had those days, today also human being is searching for the outside in whatever he has. But does not look where it really is. Upanishad says, that human being is born with a conclusion that I am an unhappy person, that I should become happy, and that happiness is out in the objects and achievements of the world. And therefore, he is searching for it whole of his life. Nantaratmanam, but he does not look at himself. So that is where this fellow, you are my guru, please tell me, where are you hiding? So we ask the guru, where is the happiness hidden? That is Vedanta gives this very simple teaching. The teaching of Vedanta can be summarized in one statement. In Vedanta it's called Mahavakya, or major statement. What's the statement? Tattvamasi, that thou art. The happiness that you are seeking, the success that you are seeking. No, Swami, I want love. Love which you are seeking. I want peace. Peace, call it peace. Call it love. Call it success. Call it happiness that we are seeking. You are that. What do you mean, I am already, happiness is, I am already happy? Then why do I feel miserable? If happiness is nature, then should I not be always feeling happy, tell me? If heat is the nature of fire, should not fire be always hot? If sweetness is the nature of honey, should not honey be always sweet? Similarly, if happiness is my nature, should I not always be happy? But I'm not. So again, that's where the teaching comes. How to own up the happiness that you are.
First thing is, tells you, you are the happiness and success that you are searching for. You ask, then, you know, how come I am not experiencing? Then you should tell you the method of the way or the process by which you can experience the happiness which is yourself.
This Vedanta tells us these two things. The goal of life and the path of life. The end and the means. The destination and the goal.
These days, Swamiji, we need not worry about the path also. We have GPS. In our days, when many years ago I first came to the United States, we did not have a MapQuest. There was no computer. There was no internet. So we go to gas station and buy those maps or write to these insurance companies, you know, or auto insurance companies or state insurance, whatever, and then I want to go from here to there, and then they send you maps and they're all marked up and accordingly you travel. But any time you always needed a map to travel, right? Without map, you get lost. Now GPS is your map. But map we should have. Where you enter the destination first, and then it says, now the route will start, route guidance will start. 400 feet, make a left turn. Go 300 meters, make a right on such and such, etc., etc. Meaning that in life also we need a GPS, right? GPS can be a global positioning system or Gita positioning system, GPS. That's what Vedanta is, a GPS, which tells us what the destination is and what's the way to reach that destination. Understand that the ancient human being also required this and the modern human being also requires that. Everything else may have changed. Our Swami was describing how things have become modern. This is some time ago. He was having a series of lecture series in Delhi, New Delhi. In the evening he was invited to bhiksha, meaning dinner. A big dining table is there and people are seated, Pujya Swami also is there, and maybe the Punjabi family. Hostess also is there. So paratha is served. And whatever is curry is served. So this woman is a modern woman. Swamiji was a sort of old fashioned Swami. So you take the paratha and, you know, split it with the fingers and dip it in the sabji and then eat it. Modern people don't do that. So what did this woman do? She took a knife, cut the paratha. Not with fingers. Then she took a fork, one piece of paratha, soaked it in the sabji, put it in her mouth. So that's called modern. But paratha is the same, understand. Hunger also is the same. Sudden things change, basic things do not change. And inasmuch as Vedanta addresses the basic problems or needs of human being has some basic needs. Two kinds of needs we have. One are what we may call material needs, others are what we may call spiritual needs. You may not like to hear the word spiritual, but we have that need. So that you need a house, you need a motor car, you need an internet, all sorts of, these are all the material needs. We need them. Vedanta does not say that
You do not need material things, you need them. But there is spiritual need. What is spiritual need? To be happy is a spiritual need. It's not a material need, you follow? You have two kinds of problems in your life. Spiritual problems and material problems. The solution should be in keeping with the nature of problems. Material problems should have material solutions. Spiritual problems should have spiritual solutions. So problem of becoming happy, it is not a material problem, it is a spiritual problem. So spiritual problems have remained the same from ancient time to today. The material problems may keep on changing, but the spiritual problem is the same. You know what we are doing? Unfortunately, for solving spiritual problem, we are going for material things. I remember myself working in New York City, you know, 5 o'clock is the time that you depart, 4:30 you get bored, you know, having spent the whole day there. So I found myself at 4:30, go down to all those vending machines, you know, put a coin, get a huge candy. When you get bored, get a candy. Get bored, cell phone. Get bored, games. Get bored, television. So this problem of boredom, is it a material problem or a spiritual problem? It is a spiritual problem. Whereas we go for material solutions. That candy was a material solution. The game is a material solution. We seem to create the delusion that my boredom is gone. My sadness is gone. My unhappiness is gone. They create an appearance of delusion. But then this thing comes back right away. As soon as the effect of that game is gone, I come back where I am. In fact, maybe with withdrawal symptoms, I mean worse than what I was before. So problem of boredom, problem of sadness, problem of stress. Stress also is a spiritual problem. Problem of depression, all of these are spiritual. When I say spiritual problems, they arise from the spirit or I. So putting it another way, there are problems centered on I, there are problems centered on non-I. Therefore, hunger, thirst, heat, cold, poverty, illiteracy, environment, all of these are problems centered on non-I. Unhappiness, sadness, boredom, stress, depression, all of these are problems centered upon I. A problem can be solved provided we have a solution which is compatible to solving that problem. Sometimes the child is crying, mother thinks the child is hungry, so she feeds. Continues to cry, feeds more. In fact, so mother thinks child is crying because hungry. In fact, child has some stomach problem. More you feed, more the problem gets aggravated. Similarly also, more we feed all these material things, more the problem seems to get aggravated. And therefore, we need what we call GPS, Gita positioning system, for those problems. Swami, if I study Gita, will I get promotion? No, that's a different situation. That's a thing centered on non-I. You may get promotion also, not that you may not get. But Gita teaches also, Vedanta teaches us how to live life properly, intelligently. So when you live life intelligently, then perhaps you'll be more effective as a person in the world also, and possibly you'll get your, you know, you progress in your career also. That's a byproduct. Basically, Vedanta teaches us to live life intelligently. What is intelligent? When you're driving the road, what is driving intelligently? When you drive on the path which leads you to your destination. And that requires constantly making choices. Keep on coming to intersection. No? Where will you go now? Come to intersection. Will you go straight? Or right or left? Where will you go? Swami will take the right. Beautiful, you know, very smooth road, tree-lined road. I'll take road. What road will you take? Right, left, or straight? Please tell me. That road which takes you to your destination. Is it not so? The intelligent thing is to take that road which leads you there. The unintelligent thing is to take a road which appears very pleasant but takes you away from a destination. Thus, there are two kinds of choices in our life. A choice which is compatible to attaining the goal of my life, but it may not be very attractive. A choice which appears very attractive, but which could very well take me away from the destination. These two kinds of choices are there. And therefore, we need guidance, need GPS. At intersection, make a right turn. Oh, but that's a miserable road. Listen, there's a lot of crowd there, a lot of, you know, that road, my GPS says that then is 15, half an hour delay. I don't want that road. Delay or no delay, that's the road that takes you to your destination, and that's what you take. Just because that road is congested or you know, there is the traffic jam, so you take a road with no traffic jam. Is that an intelligent way of doing things? No. But that's what we do. We all take convenient routes. We always avoid pain. Very often avoid doing what is right, because what is doing right is very often painful or inconvenient. We take convenient things. Thus, you have to make right choices. That's called intelligent living. That's what Vedanta teaches. What is intelligent living? How to make the right choice? What is your destination? How to reach destination? What are the values? What are the priorities? What are the attitude that you should have? In order that, your life becomes a process of reaching that destination. That's what Vedanta is. That's what a Swami is going to teach. It seems now Swami is going to start classes. We are here.
Yes, in 2 weeks we'll be starting Gita classes here Monday evening.
Monday evening, the Gita classes are to be started here. Why should you attend? Because it's GPS. GPS of life. Don't think that just because we have a flashy car, which is well tuned, the tank is full of gasoline, I'm a skilled driver, that is not enough. I should have the right map, isn't it? Sometimes GPS gets confused. Have you ever experienced that? Sometimes GPS takes you round and round. Have you ever experienced? It is possible that GPS may be wrongly programmed, in which case you go round and round, or you may possibly go in a direction opposite to your destination. So right now we have brought a GPS with us. It is wrongly programmed. And then whatever choices we are making today, they all take us in a direction quite opposite to our destination. Therefore, we have to correct that programming where? In our own mind. So Gita teaches us what the correct programming is, how to make the right choices, what intelligent living is. How to be happy, simply? Gita teaches us how to be happy. But looks like to be happy is not an easy thing. Whether it's easy or not, we cannot do without being happy. And therefore, we have to follow what Bhagavad Gita teaches. Basically, what Gita teaches is not that Swamiji, Gita, does it mean that you have to go to forest or something? Your Vedanta, will it make us renunciates? No. Please do not become renunciates. If all of you become renunciates, who will give me bhiksha? You know, who will give us bhiksha? Therefore, you do what you are doing. There is no need to change what you are doing. No need to change your attire or anything else. Change to take place in the programming. Right now we are leading a life with one kind of programming. What is needed is that change of programming. That's what Gita teaches. Meaning that don't think that you have to give up your job and home, nothing at all. In fact, I'm sure that you'll be more effective in what you're doing. Gita teaches karma yoga. Says yoga karma su kaushalam. Yoga is a skill in action. Meaning that a karma yogi is likely to be and a more effective person also. You know why? Because when can you be more effective? When you make right decisions, correct? When you make right decisions. When can you make right decisions? When you assess the situation rightly, isn't it? When a situation comes before you, first thing is to assess the situation properly and then you can make right decision. For assessing that situation properly, you require a mind which is in right place, not in wrong place. Very often our mind is in wrong place. Very often a situation comes, I get angry, I get jealous, I get excited. Many decisions are made out of competition, jealousy, excitement, revenge. All of this is wrong programming. So, with a karma yogi, a person who enjoys a mind which is in the right place, enjoys the equanimity, and then he can assess the situation very well, he can make good decisions. And therefore, he is likely to be an effective person also. So therefore, even to be effective in your career, in your family life, everywhere, in all relationships, Bhagavad Gita becomes very necessary. Because relationship also is a spiritual thing, by the way. For husband and wife to be happy, that all that relationship also is a spiritual thing. Meaning that only when you have the right values and attitudes that you can enjoy that relationship, or any relationship. So Gita will teach us what the right relationships are, what the right leadership is, what intelligent decision making is. All of this will come from Bhagavad Gita. And therefore, it is a guide in all aspects of our life. I mean, it is absolutely essential. How can you travel without a map?
Today we are traveling without the map. Bhagavad Gita provides us a map. It is like buying a new machine and trying to operate it without operating manual. How can you be? So Gita is the operating manual of the life. Most essential. And so this is what Vedanta or Gita contributes to our life, which is extremely important, in fact, indispensable. There's no choice between right and wrong. Either you make right or, you know, if you're not right, you're wrong. That's a problem. In life, if you're not right, we are wrong. Because there are two choices. And therefore, Gita teaches us how to make the right choices. It is indispensable because it is a guide or a map in our life. So with that, I conclude my talk here with a prayer. Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vashishyate Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Hari Om.